Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, so glad that you can join me for a little bit of classic cardboard conversation. And we've got an interesting show that all stems off of a previous show. Now, we're not looking back at a set we've already looked at before. We'll do that again some other time. And I'm not reheating some old topics here. I tend to do that anyways in my stream of conscious speaking. But I want to go back to February of 2019. So not that long ago, what, about 2.5 years ago? I did a show where I opened up a pack of 1978 Topps. It was an unopened pack, presumably, and didn't land any big stars, but had, I believe there were 12 cards in the pack, pretty crisp cards. And 78 Topps, if you're a longtime listener, you know, it's one of my favorite sets, as it just has this gritty 1970s listening to the Foreigner 8-track in your T-top car, and you're wearing a tank top yourself with your flowing long locks. Your hair may have looked like Farrah Fawcett would wear that hairstyle, but that was 1978. You know, the guys and the girls, it was long and flowing hair. And you just kind of get that feeling with 78 Topps, don't you? Just a real simple, clean, classic look. The backs of the cards with the play ball game. The unusual, especially for the 70s when Topps was just bathed in green ink. The unusual orange and black back to the cards. Or the orange and blue, I should say. I just love that set, and I love it so much. I think when you include that show from 2019, I think that was the third time we talked exclusively about 78 Topps on the show. And you know what? I could do 10 more shows about that set, you know, pulling a few random cards and talking about the players and the teams they talked about. And that's how impressive of a set it is. I was only a year old in 1978, yet there's just this really neat connection to the game that you get through a set like that. So even though I didn't have any star cards or single star cards, you know, we had like a National League wins leader card, something like that. And you can still watch the pack break. I still have it up on the YouTube channel at Wax and Gum Stains. And one of the cards that I found, I remember it because the pose on the card was very unique, because it looked like the hitter who was swinging the bat, it looked like he still had the hanger in his uniform. His neck was at a very stiff angle. You know, most guys, when they do the bat stance, you know, on a swing follow through, their head's tilted just a little bit. But this gentleman's head was almost at perpendicular to where the spine should be when the head is straight up. And I remember saying something like, oh, it looks like he's really stretching his neck here. And that gentleman was, in terms of a 1970 Topps card, outfielder Glenn Burke of the Los Angeles Dodgers. And I remember hearing the story about Glenn Burke, in that he was part of the creation of the high five. And the short story of how the high five was created was at the end of the 1977 season. The Dodgers were about to have four players get their 30th home run of the season, or they were going to have four players eclipse the 30th home run plateau, I should say. And the one player who needed just one more home run, he was sitting on 29 for a long time, was Dusty Baker. And in the final series of the season, I believe it was against the Houston Astros, Dusty Baker finally hit his 30th home run. In fact, it was off the recently departed J.R. Richard. And as Dusty comes around third base and everyone's happy and cheering because he helps the Dodgers reach this record, the first team to have four players hit 30 home runs or more in a season. In his exuberance, the on-deck hitter is Glenn Burke, and he raises his hand in the air. And Dusty, in his exuberance, as he's passing Glenn, slaps Burke's hands down. And that was the first official high five. And Americans, well, not just Americans, everybody globally has been doing a high five for, well, now almost 45 years. So there's that story of Glenn Burke, which I had known about. But as I was doing my research on Glenn Burke for that show, and I recall that particular show because there were only 12 cards, because we had talked about the 78 top set before, and because there weren't any huge names there, I decided, you know, what the hell, let me do a quick bio on all of these players. Well, when I got to Glenn Burke, I discovered the bigger story, and that is that Glenn Burke was the first openly gay Major League Baseball player. Now, let me clarify here. He wasn't the first gay player. There have been homosexual players for decades, centuries, if you will. But they were closeted, or they were encouraged by teams that may have, you know, subliminally thought that, you know, it would look good if, you know, they played it straight, so to speak. You know, they were coerced, bribed, you know, into marriages, sham family settings, basically, just to, you know, toe the line and make sure that baseball was still a manly men's sport. Also, when I say openly gay, Glenn Burke did not publicly come out until after his playing days. But it wasn't exactly a secret. There were many telltale signs along the way. And since it wasn't an open secret, the LA Dodgers, a quote-unquote class organization, did not want a gay player on their team. And they tried to set up Burke to get married. They tried to, you know, shuffle him around so that they didn't have this young, very impressive athlete as a face of their franchise. And when they couldn't find a quiet spot for him, when they couldn't get him to play along and stay closeted and act like he was just like any other manly man with a wife and two kids and a dog and a big green front yard, the Dodgers did something that you would think an organization that broke the color line in America 30 years before would do. And that is, they just got rid of Glenn Burke. And they not only got rid of him, they traded him to a franchise that was heading downhill fast, the Oakland Athletics. And even though Burke was born in Oakland and raised in Oakland and was a high school star and a community college star in Oakland, and while he thought it would be a chance to start over, it was not. As Glenn Burke would be ostracized by the Oakland players, certainly ostracized by Billy Martin, who would become the A's manager a couple years after Burke was traded. And this incredibly talented major league ball player, who also was an incredibly talented basketball player, was in the big leagues in 1975 and was out of the big leagues by 1979. Forced out, he technically quit. And then sadly, Glenn Burke's life went downhill from there. Unable to live his dream as a baseball player, couldn't latch on as a basketball player, which some would argue is or was his best sport to play at. And he just went downhill in a life of drug use, a life of homelessness, run-ins with the law, and tragically AIDS, which if you're old enough, you'll remember. By the 1980s, AIDS was a terrifying disease. All the liberations, all the fun of the 70s came right back in the 80s to turn everything upside down. And Glenn Burke got caught up in that, and tragically, he passed away. So I share the mini biography of Glenn Burke because I learned all of that in that one show that I did 2.5 years ago. Well, by pure chance, I want to say just within a few weeks of that program, a friend of mine on Twitter, who is a voracious book reader like I am, shared the news from a young author named Andrew Marinus that Marinus was writing a book called Singled Out, The Story of Glenn Burke. And when I saw that, I said, when that book comes out, I am buying it. Because the story intrigued me so much, I appreciated somebody doing a much deeper dive on it. And Andrew Marinus certainly did that. I bought Singled Out about a month ago, recently read it. If you follow me on my personal Twitter at Salmon Says, you'll see when I'm done reading books, I'll share my review of it on Twitter, you know, as much as I can in 280 plus or minus a few characters. And for baseball fans, Singled Out is an absolute must read because this is a story and this is a society issue that Major League Baseball has not really touched and still kind of sort of refuses to touch. But the time will come where the sport has to address it. And even if you're not a big baseball book reader, I think you'll find the story very easy to read, a relatively quick read. It's only about 275 pages, and it moves along rather fluidly, which is good. But as any good author does, when you're writing a biography on somebody, it helps to put that person's story into context. And putting that person's historical context, especially with what Glenn Burke went through. And Andrew does a great job of that, not just telling Glenn Burke's life, but also giving a parallel report on the gay rights movement in the 1970s, a parallel report on the reaction to the AIDS virus and HIV in the late 70s and 1980s, a parallel report on the opposition to gay rights. So I find it interesting, and I also want to share for those who are not interested in cultural issues, or especially if you're not interested in learning more about gay rights, or not learning more, or maybe you're flat out opposed to gay rights, and that's your opinion, that's fine. First of all, if you've made it this far in the podcast, God bless you. But I still suggest that you read it, because what's the old saying? You never know how another man lives until you walk a mile in his shoes. Put on Glenn Burke's shoes here and read Singled Out. Now, we're going to explore the story of Glenn Burke a little more in this podcast, as I am very thankful to have had the opportunity to speak with Andrew Marinus earlier this week. And I'll play back that interview in just a few minutes. And Andrew will tell some more details about the story. And on top of that, he'll let you know about some other things he's got in the works. And Andrew is a really good author and just a great guy. I'm so glad I was able to connect with him and be able to share his path to telling Glenn Burke's story. So we'll do that in just a moment. And then after the interview, when we do our bottom of the order, when we pick three cards at random. Now, obviously, I'm not opening up a pack of cards here, so they're not really random selections. But I selected three players who were very important in the story of Glenn Burke for good and bad reasons. And a couple of the players that were key in the story, we've already done little bios for, including Dusty Baker and also Rick Monday. But I decided to talk about Davey Lopes. We also will talk about Mike Norris, the Oakland Athletics pitcher, who is also from the Bay Area, who grew up with Glenn Burke and was very briefly a teammate of his in Oakland. And then Vic Davalio. And you're probably going, Vic Davalio? What does Vic Davalio have to do with the Glenn Burke story? Didn't Vic Davalio play in the 1960s? Yes, he did. But he also played in the 70s. And boy, he was hanging on in the late 70s. But he is part of the comically tragic attempt by the Dodgers to explain their way out of not including Glenn Burke in their present and future plans heading into the 1978 season. So I thought that would be an interesting spectrum of players. Like I said, we had already talked about Dusty Baker, Rick Monday, Don Sutton as well. But I thought Davey Lopes, a leader in the Dodger locker room, which for the most part accepted Glenn Burke. Mike Norris, fellow Bay Area friend of Burke's, who was with the Oakland A's. And then Vic Davalio, who through no fault of his, was again part of that comically bad and tragic response by the Dodgers and how to, quote unquote, handle the Glenn Burke situation in spring training 1978. Now, before the interview, I do want to remind you that we'll have another podcast coming your way 2 weeks from today. That'll be Friday, August 27th. We will get back into diving into the cards. And this time we're going to go all the way back to the 1950s. So we'll fire up the flux capacitor and we will post the polls on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains, asking you which set from the 1950s do we want to take a second look at. A set that we've only looked at once and we just moved on from. We did this recently with a couple of different eras, the 1980s as well as the Junk Wax era, and had a lot of fun doing that. And I have already told you that we're not going to put up the layup sets. You know, everyone can talk about 53 tops and 53 Bowman and 56 tops. But we're going to look back. I'm going to bring up four suggestions, sets that deserve a second deeper look. So we'll do that for the 1950s. That again, coming up on Friday, August the 27th. Also coming down the pike, we'll do revisit sessions for a set from the 1960s and the 1970s. And I do believe we'll go ahead and put this in order following the August 27th show. We'll jump back into the Junk Wax era and open up a couple of packs of 1993 Fleer. That was one of those sets that, because I was burning out a little bit in 1993, and there were just so many damn choices for cards, I did spend a lot of time or money with 1993 Fleer. And it will be a nice revisit for me as well, because I do recall buying maybe three or four packs back then, but pushing them to the side. What was I buying in 93? Well, Topps was a big set for me. Topps, Donruss was up there. Let's see, was Score? No, not really. Score was kind of going down then. I think Stadium Club, Upper Deck. Yeah, I was buying a lot of Upper Deck. And Triple Play, of course. have to have some Triple Play in there. But yeah, Fleer just never quite broke through for me. Fleer Ultra. Yeah, I bought a lot of Fleer Ultra. But the Fleer base set was dying on the vine, in my opinion, back then, as it suffered the same fate as Score, as well as Donruss, you know, some of the main base sets of the 1980s getting pushed aside for the bigger, pricier, flashier premium sets at that time. So we'll be discussing that. Also, I am actively looking to upgrade the Wax and Gum Stains website. I've been threatening to release that to you. And I am putting some time and thought into it right now. So hopefully waxandgumstains.com can come out relatively soon. And as I've said before, it will be a complement to the podcast. So if you just need some baseball card or sports card, as our survey detected, we can feel free to talk about other sports there. If you need just some kind of a wax fix, hopefully I'll be able to post something once a week or twice a week just to carry you along in between shows. And as always, you can reach me via email, waxandgumstains.com. And if you have any questions about the show, show topics, or if you want to inquire about a donation, be it a cash or cardboard donation, do so via email, waxandgumstains.com, or send me a DM or just post on my timeline at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. All right. Without further ado, I told you a lot about the Glenn Burke story, but to give you some more details about how he came about the Glenn Burke story and some very interesting storylines, including an interesting take about Disco Demolition Night at Comiskey Park in Chicago in 1979. I bring you our guest, Andrew Marinus. Well, I am very pleased to bring in a gentleman who has written one hell of a book, and it was a book that I was looking forward to as soon as I saw it publicized, I want to say a couple of years ago, and that's because it timed out well with a podcast we had done where I had opened up a pack of 1978 Topps cards, and one of the cards in the pack was Glenn Burke. And as we like to do on the show, do a little deep dive on some of the players, and this was the first time I had learned Glenn Burke's whole story. I knew he was influential in the creation of the High Five, but there was so much more to it, and thankfully Andrew Marinus has written more about it, the entire story of Glenn Burke, and it's called Singled Out. It's a great book, just finished reading it, and it's been on the market for several months now. We're pleased to be joined by Andrew. Andrew, thank you so much for taking some time to join us on Wax Ecstatic today.
Hey, thank you, Matt. And it's great that you mentioned Glenn's 1978 baseball card. I remember having that card when I was a kid, you know, and when I got started on this book, I imagined that card in my mind. I could picture, you know, he's there, sort of that classic Topps posed swing, you know, looks like maybe it was in Candlestick Park, mm-hmm. somewhere on the road in his Dodger gray. But that was one of the first images that popped in my mind, was that same baseball card when I got started on this project.
Yeah, and I recall going through that, and I still have the video of it. I'm going to have to watch it again, because the one thing that stuck out to me was, you had Glenn in that pose, but the way that his head was tilted, it looked like he had this really serious crick in his neck. And I'm like, what is he still wearing the hanger in his jersey there? But like I said, you know, it was fun to look at it. But then when we learned a little more about him, it's just like, wow, there's a lot going on here. And, you know, Andrew, that leads me to, you know, you recall that 1978 Topps card. And I just want to start off by how you got onto this project, because your two previous books, which are Strong Inside and Game of Deception, basketball books, and not just any old basketball book, race relations in Strong Inside, and then the Olympic basketball team in 1936 in Berlin with Game of Deception. So you had the basketball start here. What leads you to writing a book about a guy who on the surface plays 225 Major League Baseball games, has a batting average of .237, and other than being part of the creation of the High Five is sadly somewhat overlooked. How did you just go, yeah, that's the book I've got to write there?
Yeah, well, you mentioned the first two books. Strong Inside was a biography of Perry Wallace, who was the first black basketball player in the SEC at Vanderbilt in the late 60s. So it's a story about basketball, but also about mm-hmm. the civil rights movement and what it was like to be a teenager put in that position, you know, to desegregate the toughest league to desegregate, the SEC. Second book, Games of Deception, on the first U.S. Olympic men's basketball team at the 1936 Olympics in Nazi Germany. So again, a sports book, but really with a larger social message to it, you know, about the state of the world at that time and fascism and what it was like to be an athlete at those Olympics. And so with this book, you're right. I mean, Glenn Burke is not a Hall of Fame caliber baseball player, but he was the first openly gay Major League Baseball player. And I thought that alone could lead to an interesting story. And when I did a little bit of research about Glenn and discovered a lot more about his life and the way he was received by his Dodger teammates, the way he was run out of the game by management of the Dodgers and the Oakland A's, I thought it would be a great opportunity to write about my favorite sport, which is baseball, even though the first two books were basketball. I love basketball too, but I've always considered myself a baseball guy first. But to tell an important and overlooked story about baseball that took place in the decade where I first sort of became a baseball fan. I was born in 1970. So those players of the late 70s, early 80s were the ones that I knew by heart. You know, I'm a Milwaukee Brewers fan. So they were coming along as a really good team in 78, 79, 80, 81, 82, you know, and Glenn was playing from roughly 76 to 79. So that was right in my wheelhouse. And but to place his story in the context of the gay rights movement in the 70s and the backlash to that movement, that's what I thought would make it an especially interesting story beyond just the baseball.
And as you started digging in a little more about Glenn's not just career, but his life, what were maybe some of the first surprises, some of the interesting things that you learned about Glenn and his life while writing this book?
One thing I was surprised about, one thing was that how popular he was amongst his Dodger teammates. You know, oftentimes, even media and fans today, you know, if they're talking about the prospect of a gay player on a baseball team or any other team, will allude to a supposed distraction that that player would cause, you know, in the clubhouse or in the locker room. With Glenn, it was that was anything but the case. He was the most popular player on the Dodger team. Even as a rookie fourth outfielder that most of his teammates knew was gay. When he was traded to the Oakland A's, there were reporters who wrote in the next day's paper about seeing Dodger veteran players like Don Sutton and Steve Garvey sitting at their lockers crying about the fact that Glenn had been traded. You know, so I going into the project, wondered, you know, what would the reception be among his teammates? I was surprised that he was, you know, that popular. The other thing that was surprising to his contemporaries in baseball, once they found out that he was gay, they didn't think that a gay man could be that athletic. Mm-hmm. You know, that was sort of the stereotype of the time. And Glenn was the best athlete that any of them ever saw. I interviewed Rupert Jones, who had gone to Berkeley High School just like Glenn. Rupert said he was the best athlete he ever saw in any sport. As a high school senior, Glenn led his high school team, Berkeley High, to a undefeated season and the Northern California championship. He played briefly college basketball while he was also playing in the minor leagues. He could touch the top of the backboard, you know, from a standstill. He had 17-inch biceps. He was incredibly fast, set stolen base records at different levels of the minor leagues. And so the stereotypes that people had about gay men of being, you know, effeminate and weak or whatever, Glenn just blasted mm-hmm. all of those stereotypes at that time.
Andrew Marinus, the author of Singled Out, joining us on Wax Ecstatic. You mentioned Glenn's talents, not just this God-given physical specimen that he was, but he could do just amazing things. He was fast. He could throw. He could, play as well as any basketball player in high school and college. And he certainly wouldn't be the first dual sport player. There's a lot of history, a lot of major leaguers who starred in football or basketball or other sports. But I have to wonder, Andrew, and I need to preface this by saying that, you know, I'm not saying that he shouldn't have been, publicly dealing with his sexuality, that, he shouldn't have kept himself in the closet. But I'm just wondering, given what we know of him now and what he was able to accomplish as an athlete, had his sexuality not been public, had he chosen to just kind of play along the game, would we be talking about Glenn Burke in like the Bo Jackson kind of comparisons or Ken Griffey Jr.? I mean, this guy had, and again, I'm not saying he should have stayed in the closet, but had this not been such an overwhelming story in his life, could we be talking about somebody that was in the game for 15, 20 years and did phenomenal things and perhaps if he stayed healthy, could have been a Hall of Fame candidate?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Junior Gilliam, the longtime Dodger coach, said that Glenn had the talent to be the next Willie Mays. You know, so he was someone that was highly regarded as a baseball player and a basketball player. It's a complicated question, though, because in some ways, Glenn was open, and in some ways he was still closeted, you know, while he was a major leaguer. So I think, and I say that to mean that most of his teammates knew that he was gay. Dodger management certainly knew that he was, and that's the reason why they offered him a bribe. We can talk about that, to cover mm-hmm. it up, and ultimately traded him to the A's. Billy Martin certainly knew. That's why he demoted Glenn to the minor leagues and said he would never let him play for him. But Glenn never publicly came out to just fans and the world until after his playing days were over. So in some respects, he still was looking over his shoulder, even as a major league player, wondering if his secret would get, his open secret would get out to the rest of the world. And I think that living with that that secret to the extent it was still a secret was debilitating to his success as an athlete. You know, you've got to be mentally free to succeed, especially as a hitter in the major leagues. The other thing I would say is that another way to phrase that question would be, if there were not homophobia, would Glenn have been able to succeed? You know, and I think that's probably the better question, you know, because it poses the question to all the rest of us and not just to Glenn. You know, and when we create these atmospheres that don't allow people to truly be who they are and to function, you know, at ease, you know, what we're denying them is also denying the rest of us something. You know, we could have seen that Bo Jackson type of player potentially with Glenn. And the sad thing is we simply don't know, because he wasn't allowed to pursue his dream of being a Major League Baseball player by people who were homophobic.
And you mentioned the homophobia, which during the late 1970s was very rampant. You really do a great parallel check-in with some of the social outcry, shall we call it, from conservatives, Anita Bryant in particular, who certainly had her own issues to deal with, never mind sticking her nose in other people's business. And by the way, regardless of anyone's political leanings, if you remove the phrase gay rights from the arguments that you read in this book and replace it with some more contemporary issues, not that gay rights isn't, I think there's more of an openness to it now than 40 years ago, but if you replace it with immigration or you know, mask mandates, stuff like that, if you do that while reading this, you're going to shake your head because you hear a very familiar tone, unfortunately. But you know, talking about that homophobia, and you mentioned the bribe, I don't want to give away the whole book here, but really a big turning point where, instead of embracing Glenn Burke for the athlete and the person that he was, and perhaps talking to the teammates, you mentioned Steve Garvey and Don Sutton and Davey Lopes, among others, you know, the leaders who you know, if didn't accept Glenn Burke, at least tolerated him. The Dodgers general manager Al Campanis decided to go another way. And what may be shocking is that what he and the Dodgers proposed, Glenn Burke wasn't the first person to probably have an offer like this. Share a little bit about the breaking point for the Dodgers that eventually sent Glenn to a pretty terrible Oakland team in 1979.
Yeah, and I should also mention Dusty Baker as being one of Glenn's strongest advocates in that clubhouse also. And I got a chance to interview Dusty for the book, and everyone had told me what a great guy he was, and he exactly was that. You know, it was a great few hours I got to spend with him. Well, you know, Tommy Lasorda was the manager, of course, of the Dodgers back then. And Tommy's son, Tommy Jr., was gay. And it was pretty obvious to the Dodger players that was the case. Glenn became friends with Tommy Jr., whose nickname was Spunky Lasorda. And they started to spend a lot of time together. Tommy Sr. wasn't too happy about this. Al Campanis was not happy about the idea of having a gay player on the team. This is an organization that was very sort of public relations focused, you know, maybe not too surprising being out there in Hollywood, you know. And so after the 77 season, when Glenn has started two games in the NLCS against the Phillies, he started game one at Yankee Stadium at the World Series. He's had a pretty good year as a rookie outfielder. And during that offseason, Campanis came up to the Bay Area to visit with Glenn. Glenn thought it was a meeting to talk about his role on the team the next year. Instead, Campanis said, "We'd like you to get married." And Glenn said, "To a woman?" And when Campanis said yes, Glenn said he wasn't going to do that. And Campanis said, "Well, you know, Glenn, what we've done for a number of other players, we feel like they play better, you know, when they're married, remove some distractions or something. So we like to help pay for their honeymoon." And he said he would give Glenn $75,000 for a nice honeymoon. which would be a heck of a honeymoon in 2021, let alone 1977. You know, so Glenn understood that this was a bribe offer to cover up his sexuality, and he refused to go along with it, you know, which was a pretty courageous move on Glenn's part, because I think he knew at that moment in that meeting in the hotel when he turns down the bribe, he really was ending his days with the Dodgers. And so early in spring training, the following spring, there are articles in the LA papers about Glenn Burke's days being numbered with the team. And the sports writers didn't know why. You know, Campanis and Lasorda weren't really giving the truth of why. They were saying, oh, he's not developing as a hitter, you know, and he has a bad attitude, things like that. And so there were these articles that his days were numbered. And then early in the season, he was traded to the Oakland A's. And Glenn had grown up in Oakland and Berkeley, and he thought this might be, you know, an ideal chance to save his career. Mm-hmm. A's were terrible back then, of course. This is when they were drawing, you know, maybe at less than 1,000 fans to their game. Charlie Finley was trying to sell the team. And it doesn't turn out to be anything like Glenn had imagined. His teammates were much more homophobic there. They hadn't really come through the minor leagues with him. They weren't as supportive of him. Billy Martin's eventually hired as the manager there, and he said he's not going to let Glenn, quote unquote, contaminate his team. And so this was a really brief career that had gone from the World Series, like I said, to out of baseball within 2 years.
Andrew Marinus, author of Singled Out, joining us on Wax Ecstatic. You mentioned being able to talk to a lot of Glenn's former teammates, not just with the Dodgers, but with the A's, and plenty of connections from his high school and various college teams as well. But you also talked to family members. You were able to track down a sister and get her perspective of him growing up. When you pull everybody together, because I'm sure this is a topic that hadn't received much national coverage other than when Glenn came out on the Today Show in what was it, 1983, you know, it got a little coverage here and there, but again, to my knowledge, there hasn't been, outside of Glenn's autobiography, much of a deep dive into this. Do you think family and friends and teammates, they were maybe a little relieved that the story's being told here and Glenn is being given the you know, proper treatment here all these years later?
I think some people were. I think some people were still reluctant to get into the story. You know, Lutha and Paula, two of Glenn's sisters that I interviewed for the book, you know, they were great. I had heard that Lutha was an angel, you know, from Eric Sherman, who ghost wrote Glenn's autobiography that you mentioned when Glenn was dying. And Lutha was incredibly helpful as I was working on this book and had great stories about the family and about Glenn's last days also. You know, when he was dying of AIDS, he was living in her house. And so that was an important period to write about. There were certain teammates from the Dodger days that were great. Dusty Baker, Davey Lopes in particular. Mike Norris and Shooty Babbitt, two of his teammates from the A's, were. But there were a number of Dodger teammates that I knew I had correct contact information for who never replied, you know, to requests for interviews for the book. Dodger organization itself was not helpful as I was working on the book. A's organization was a little bit better, at least in terms of returning emails and calls, but ultimately wasn't helpful either. So I think there was a sense within Major League Baseball that this was a story that was embarrassing in some ways, you know, and that they didn't want to get into it, which was really disappointing to me because I feel like the only way to progress is to talk about things, you know, and to deal with the past honestly. And then the Dodgers and A's could be the very most credible leaders on this issue in the major leagues, and yet they seemed reluctant to do it. The A's, to their credit, renamed their Pride Night after Glenn Burke this year, but they didn't want to do anything with the book, which was disappointing. Again, I think, you know, celebrating someone without really telling their whole story is not quite an honor, you know. Yeah. So we'll see what happens in the future.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because Major League Baseball, you know, obviously has wrapped around the Jackie Robinson story, more and more Roberto Clemente's life. But maybe over time, you know, as we mentioned, social views of homosexuality and gay rights has changed a lot over the last 40 years. Maybe over time, that's something that teams in the league warm up to as well. Andrew, I want to ask you just a couple more questions. First, an interesting point of view you have in Singled Out is Disco Demolition Night in Comiskey Park in 1979. Now, to me and to a lot of people, we think of Disco Demolition Night as that wacky Bill Veeck creation. You know, he teams up with The Loop, WLUP Radio. In between the doubleheader, they're going to blow up all these disco records that fans brought in. And of course, we know the rest of the story. The fans are drunk and wild and crazy. The pyrotechnics go wild. There's a giant crater in the outfield from this, and they had to forfeit the White Sox the second game of that doubleheader to the Tigers. But I think you brought up a very interesting parallel to society about Disco Demolition Night. Could you share that, please?
Yeah, you know, and this was a fun chapter for me to write. When I was thinking about, you know, what happened in baseball during the time that Glenn was playing and realized that Disco Demolition Night happened in a season in which he played. He had already actually quit the A's that season before the night happened. I thought, is there any way that I can write about this in the book? And there really was a legit way to write about it. So, and it involves an undercurrent of homophobia just across American society at that time. So this is during the 79 season. Glenn's with the A's, and he's feeling a lot of tension in the clubhouse. You mentioned Anita Bryant. You know, there's all sorts of anti-gay rights campaigns around the country at this time. And there's even an incident at the Coliseum in Oakland where Glenn is harassed by one of the A's own fans, you know, calling him the F word. And it's echoing throughout the Coliseum because there's nobody there and you can hear anything that anyone is saying. Glenn confronts this fan in the parking lot after the game. And I found a fan who was there who talked about seeing the fight, you know. And so Glenn's feeling a greater level, I think, of homophobia than at any point in his career during that 79 season. So he eventually says, I'm tired of this. And he quits. He comes back the next year when briefly in spring training. But, you know, a couple weeks after Glenn is driven from the game, you could say, because of this homophobic environment, Disco Demolition Night takes place. And in one respect, you know, it's just a kind of a crazy, wacky night. And, you know, I think even people who loved disco at the time would admit it wasn't necessarily like the greatest genre of music of all time or something, right? I mean, there's a lot of fun songs, but the promotion was, you know, some people were getting sick of disco and they wore t-shirts that said disco sucks and they were gonna blow up these albums. But there was an undercurrent to the backlash against disco that, disco really had been popularized in the Latinx and Black and gay communities in the big cities of this country. And so what replaced it was a brand of music that was primarily white, right? And so, and straight. And some of the backlash to disco, music writers and music historians have said, really fit with this undercurrent of homophobia in the country at that time. And so I don't say that, you know, everyone that showed up at Comiskey that night was homophobic or had that on their mind, but the whole movement against disco was kind of based on some of those same types of feelings. And it was interesting that that night occurred right at the same time that Glenn was feeling this heat unlike ever before and was, you know, forced to quit the game.
Yeah, I thought that was a very interesting, that was an angle of that event I had never thought of or considered, and I thought it was interesting. And I encourage our listeners to read Singled Out by Andrew Marinus. Not only is it covering the battles that Glenn Burke fought as a homosexual who was publicly out, but also an African-American in the late 1970s, still many struggles there. Also, you know, unfortunately, the neighborhood he grew up in and you know, a popular side habit for a lot of people, recreational drugs. And, you know, Glenn fell down that rabbit hole. And Mike Norris, who we'll be talking about later in this podcast, suffered through a lot of the same, you know, issues with battling drugs that Glenn did. Thankfully for Mike, he was able to pull himself out. He had a lot of help there. But it really was a triple whammy for Glenn Burke. And for more information on that, again, Singled Out is a great book on that. Andrew, last but not least, what other projects are you working on? Do you have anything in the hopper you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So before we got on this interview, I was working on chapter 20 of my next book. I've got about four more to write. This one will be called Inaugural Ballers, and it's the story of the first U.S. women's Olympic basketball team, which played at the 1976 Olympics in Montreal. And they won the silver medal, which would be a disappointment now, right? I think we won seven straight gold medals in women's basketball in the Olympics. But at the time, that was considered an incredible upset. Soviets hadn't lost an international game since 1958, so we knew there was no chance of beating them in those Olympics. The U.S. wasn't even supposed to qualify, but they made it and won the silver. There's three players that most basketball fans have heard of that were on that team. Nancy Lieberman, Ann Myers, and Pat Summitt, when she was Pat Head, was a player on that team. And probably their best player was a woman named Lucy Harris from Delta State, who was a pioneering black women's basketball player at the time. So this has been a really fun book to write. Again, set in the 1970s, in this case, in the context of women's rights movement of the early 70s. And it'll come out next year, which is the 50th anniversary of Title IX. That had such a big impact on women's sports.
Excellent. And just full disclosure, before we started this interview, I suggested another book in the works should be Your Year. Talk about inaugural ballers. The 1998 Tampa Bay Devil Rays and the circus that was underneath the tent at Tropicana Field, Vince Namoli and Chuck Lamar in the middle of the three rings. So when that comes around, let me know, because we'll round up the usual suspects, and boy, will that be an interesting story to tell, or a few stories, I would imagine.
That would be fun, man. Yeah, I was the media relations manager for the Rays that season. And I'll tell you one story. So at the end of the year, I knew I was going to be moving back to Nashville for sort of relationship reasons at the time. And Larry Rothschild was the manager of the Rays. And the last road trip of the year was to Boston and New York. And when we were at Fenway, he said, "Get ready. When we get to Yankee Stadium, I'm going to let you take batting practice as your going away present." And so one day I got to take BP. Wade Boggs was leaning on the cage, you know, while I'm stepping in with Mike DeFelice's bat, and had never even really swung a wooden bat in my life. Frank Howard was the BP pitcher that day, and they let me hit for about 10 minutes and signed the bat for me afterwards. It was really a big thrill, something I'll never forget.
Having the Capitol Punisher throwing pitches your direction, terrorizing or thrilling?
Well, a little bit. The real players, you know, they were taking BP too, and they were squaring to bunt the first couple pitches. And so when he was about to throw me the first pitch, I squared around to bunt too. And he pulled up midway through, and he's like, "Just swing the bat, son. You know, like, stop wasting my time, basically." So that was awesome.
And a happy belated birthday to Hondo. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate you taking the time out tonight. Folks, give Andrew a follow on Twitter at TrueBlue24. That's TrueBlue24. Or on Instagram at Amarinus. That's AmaRanISS. And please get Singled Out. It is an incredible story, not just about an incredible athlete in person in Glenn Burke, but also a lot of social issues going on at the time in the 1970s that we're still dealing with these days here. Maybe the name of the issue is different, but certainly the outcry is the same, unfortunately. And I've always said history doesn't repeat, but it's got a pretty fat backbeat. And I think you'll pick that up here. Andrew, thank you again, and a great job, and best of luck to you on the next book.
Oh, thank you so much, Matt. I appreciate all the kind words, and thanks for finding me and inviting me to be on your podcast.
My thanks again to Andrew Marinus for joining me earlier this week. And again, you need to, even if you're not big on any of the society storylines throughout the story of Glenn Burke, you need to know about the story of Glenn Burke. And I strongly suggest picking up a copy of Singled Out by Andrew Marinus, or any of his previous two books, and keep an eye out for the inaugural Ballers book, which he mentioned should be available next year. Now, one other quick story, I forgot to bring it up with Andrew, and I think you'll find this very, very intriguing too. As I mentioned, and as is probably well known, Glenn Burke was part of the creation of the high five. Also, in 1977, Glenn Burke was unknowingly an influencer for the Nike Corporation. And Marinus has the entire story in Singled Out, but I'll give you a brief overview. Basically, Glenn Burke became friends with a person who was owner of a local shoe store, an athletic shoe store, and he gave Glenn a pair of shoes that he thought would be good for him. And Glenn liked the shoes because they had some pretty good cleats to them, which would help him perform better on AstroTurf. And of course, in the late 70s, a lot of National League ballparks were AstroTurf. So he thought that this would help his game, and he liked them. They were comfortable. They seemingly helped him out in the outfield. And he colored the shoes to match his uniform. A couple of his teammates liked the shoes and put them on. And all of a sudden, you had a whole slew, by the 1977 World Series, a whole slew of Los Angeles Dodgers wearing these new Nike shoes. And Nike had only been around for a few years. They were not the behemoth that they are today. But Glenn Burke, yeah, was unknowingly an influencer in the Nike brand, which of course would blow wide open in the 1980s and beyond. Now, for more interesting stories, check out Singled Out by Andrew Marinus. Now, let's get to the bottom of the order of the three players that I chose from the story of Glenn Burke to share a little bit about. And it should come as no surprise that Davey Lopes was the leader in the locker room for the Dodgers who tried to help Glenn Burke out in his brief time with Los Angeles, as he was one of the official captains for the Los Angeles Dodgers starting in the late 1970s. At that time, only five team captains in history, and he was number five. So let's talk a little bit about David Earl Lopes, a native of East Providence, Rhode Island, where he was a star basketball player and baseball player as well at the LaSalle Academy in Providence. After graduating from high school, he would go on to earning NAIA All-Star American Honors in baseball at Wesleyan University in Mount Pleasant, and he would later transfer to beautiful Topeka, Kansas at Washburn University, where he was, again, a star in baseball. In fact, in the 1967 season, hit .380 as well as 9 home runs. And oh, by the way, he was still playing basketball at the time. I found this interesting. Davey Lopes earned a bachelor's degree in elementary education and was actually briefly a sixth grade teacher. And education was very important to Davey Lopes, especially because not everybody from his neighborhood was so fortunate to get a full education and to utilize it. Well, he certainly did. And even after major league teams were pursuing him, he was rebuffing them. He was going to finish his education and continue to teach in classes, and he was going to come to the big leagues when he was ready. He was actually drafted by the San Francisco Giants. How about that? In June of 1967, in the 8th round, he decided to turn them down and stay in school. The Dodgers would sign him in the free agent draft in 1968. And even though he was property of the Dodgers and signed with them, he actually turned down spring training invitations twice to finish up his education. Now, he would start in the minor leagues in 1968 in Daytona Beach and working his way up through the farm system. In 1970, when he got to Spokane, which was the Dodgers' AAA farm club, their manager, Tommy Lasorda, was working with Lopes, who at the time was an outfielder, and Lasorda figured that Lopes would be better positioned at second base. So credit Tommy Lasorda, as much as we bash him when talking about the Glenn Burke story. He was able to see what Davey Lopes could do, and he was able to convert him into a second baseman, and that is where Lopes would find success, but not instantly. Even though he did have a cup of coffee at the end of the 1972 season, he failed to make the roster as the starting second baseman in 1973. The veteran Lee Lacy won the job. However, Lacy got off to a slow start. So Lopes moves right on in, and he would be the final piece to a very impressive infield that would serve the Dodgers well into the early 1980s, with Steve Garvey at first base, Lopes at second, Bill Russell at short, and the Penguin Ron Say at third. In fact, it was the longest intact starting infield in Major League history. These guys were together from 1973 through 1981. Often the leadoff hitter, a very speedy guy too. Lopes was stealing bases left and right. He found out on the field he could be a spark plug with that speed. He also discovered his true leadership style off the field in the clubhouse. Again, with a little goading from Lasorda, he emerged as the undisputed leader of the Dodger locker room. And they had reportedly some great leaders, including Say and Steve Garvey and Don Sutton and many others. But there's something about Lopes' style and approach to everything that really made players and coaches gravitate to him. Now, he would star in the 1977 and 78 World Series, although the Dodgers came up short twice against the Yankees, but finally would prove to be victorious in the 1981 series against the Yankees, in which the Dodgers came back from a 2-0 deficit and won that series in 6 games. He was an all-star at second base for 4 consecutive seasons with the Dodgers from 1978 to 1981. He also, at one point in time, held a major league record for most consecutive steal attempts without getting thrown out. And let me pull that number here. Yes, 38 consecutive bases stolen in 1975. That was a 53-year-old record set by Max Carey. Now, Lopes' record would eventually get surpassed by Vince Coleman in 1989. But a deceptively fast guy, Davey Lopes. But also, he was able to maintain his physique to keep going for many, many years. But the Dodgers, looking to cycle through the veterans and bring in some new, younger talent, decided to trade Lopes to the Oakland Athletics, as they were bringing Steve Sachs up as a second baseman. So they let him go for not much, basically bringing in minor leaguer Lance Hudson in exchange for Lopes. And Lopes still had some speed in his feet. He teamed up with Ricky Henderson to steal 158 bases in 1982. That would set a new American League record for teammates. Granted, Henderson had 130 of them, but Lopes was part of the record that happened there. By the way, he was twice the National League stolen base leader in 1975 and 1976. Continued to show some good hands in the infield. The Gold Glove winner in 1978, proving his worth in the American League, was not relegated to designated hitter duties. He was able to assist the A's as they were rebuilding throughout the 82, 83, and most of the 84 season. The A's traded him to Chicago. He was the player to be named later in a deal for Chuck Rainey in August of 1984. So Lopes was part of the Cubs' playoff drive against Garvey and the Padres in 1984. He would stay with Chicago through July of 1986, where he was later traded to Houston for Frank Dipino. At the age of 40 in 1986, he stole 47 bases. And then, not to be outdone, in 1987, despite dealing with arm injuries, he would go on to steal 35 bases at the age of 41. Now, at the end of the 1987 season, he decided to call it a career. 1,812 games played, a career .263 batting average, 155 home runs, and 557 stolen bases. So a tremendous combination of leadership, of energy, but also speed, power, contact as well. He was what the scouts would say, a complete player. And he would very quickly turn towards coaching, as he was brought on board by the Texas Rangers after his career ended. Moved along as a first base coach for the Baltimore Orioles, later the San Diego Padres. Hired by the Milwaukee Brewers as their manager in 2000. And got involved in a little brouhaha with his former teammate in Henderson. The Brewers at the time were getting drilled by the San Diego Padres. Padres had a 7-run lead in the 7th inning, and Henderson stole second base. Well, Lopes got his panties in a wad over that and pulled out the old unwritten book, the unwritten rules of baseball book, and said, "You're not supposed to steal second base when you're up by 7 runs." And, you know, he threatened to, you know, bean Henderson, and wisely the Padres pulled Henderson from the lineup after this incident. And Lopes was really making a big stink of this. Well, lo and behold, the following day, the Elias Sports Bureau produced a list featuring the 7 times in Lopes' playing career that he had stolen a base while his team was leading by 7 or more runs. The Brewers did not perform very well with Lopes as a manager. 15 games into the 2002 season, he was fired. He would go back to his role as a first base coach with the Padres, later the Washington Nationals and the Phillies, and he would win a World Series ring with the Phillies in 2008. In fact, while he was a coach with the Phillies, the team led the majors in stolen base percentage, including an MLB history best. In 2007, the Phillies stole 138 bases on 157 attempts. That's an 87.9% stolen base percentage. Pretty impressive. After his run in Philadelphia, he would be first base coach with the Dodgers, later returned to the Washington Nationals, and he decided to retire from coaching after the 2017 season. Davey Lopes is a prostate cancer survivor, thoroughly beat that when he was diagnosed back in February of 2008, and his hometown of Providence, Rhode Island, back in December of 1988, honored Lopes by passing a resolution to name a pool and recreation center after him. Now, the next player we're going to talk about is a player who had a lot of similarities to Glenn Burke. And in fact, he fought a lot of the same battles as Burke. Fortunately for this gentleman, it turned out with a much happier ending, although it could have gone horribly awry at many points in his life. And he was on the precipice of disaster numerous times. Talking about Michael Kelvin Norris. Yes, Mike Norris. A San Francisco native, born in San Francisco in 1955, and also a star in high school. In fact, Balboa High School was where he starred in baseball, and he very quickly got the attention of major league teams, as the Oakland A's would select him out of City College of San Francisco in the 1973 winter draft, selected him in the first round, 24th overall, very quickly working his way through the Oakland Athletics Farm Club. And that's quite an accomplishment given what pitchers were already in Oakland. He was able to blaze a path and make his debut in 1975. In fact, winning a spot on the A's roster out of opening or out of spring training, his first start, shutting out the Chicago White Sox, he faced just 32 batters. Pretty good impression to make there. Now, he did have a limited amount of time with the A's in 1975 because, like I said, they had some pretty good guys in front of him. So he appears in just 4 games with 3 starts, but makes a good impression, goes back down to the minor leagues. By the time the 1976 season starts, he is a regular starter for the A's. Now, the A's are starting to dismantle the team in 1976. So he would be one of the few stars that would remain. Of course, he had a very affordable contract. And as he was starring with the A's, he was still struggling because he didn't have a lot of support around him. Well, as some of the young talent that the A's were pulling together started to mature, so did Mike Norris. And you started to see a tremendous turnaround in 1980, in part because of Billy Martin. Martin would run real deep with his starters. He had a talented starting rotation in 1980 with other pitchers such as Steve McCaddy, Matty Keough, and Rick Langford. Well, Mike Norris was one of the horses of the staff, and he would average, okay, get this, he would average throwing 131 pitches per complete game. Oh, I should mention in 1980, he pitched a mere 24 complete games, didn't lead the league in complete games. That shows you how different pitching was in 1980 compared to today. But 24 complete games averaged 131 pitches per complete game start, and he was able to surge his way through the win column with a 22-9 record and a 2.53 earned run average. Now, keep in mind, 22 wins, that was more than four times his previous career high, which he set the previous season, 1979, with five. And his earned run average was about half of what he had compiled in his first four full seasons. So 1980 was a breakthrough season for Norris, as well as the A's, as they were starting to turn things around. Unfortunately, and Billy Martin can be blamed for this, Billy Martin burned through the pitching staff. He had a lot of arm injuries and a lot of tired young pitchers come 1981. And even though Norris was an all-star in 1981, he struggled a little bit, to say the least, especially compared to 1980, with a 12-9 record, and his earned run average was up 1.2 points to a 3.75. Now, he was dealing with arm injuries at that point in time, was never really able to find himself once again, slowly started slipping through the following seasons, 1982 and 1983. And after the 1983 season, as a quote-unquote washed-up 28-year-old, his career was almost done. He was in the A's farm system for a couple of years after the 1985 season was granted free agency. And that would seem to be the end of the Mike Norris story. Well, that's the end of the story on the field. Unfortunately, off the field, things got even worse. He was suffering from a drug habit in New Year's Day, 1986. He consumed $300 worth of cocaine on New Year's Eve. So on New Year's Day, 1986, waking up from this stupor, he declares, okay, I am done with the drugs. It was something that, you know, he'd been doing drugs for a long time, fully involved in the cocaine scene. And finally, on that New Year's Eve, 1985-1986 time period, he finally hit the wall and claims that he has never relapsed. And hopefully that's true and that's good. And you can see how he was able to turn things around. First of all, by meeting a very special person in his life, a flight attendant by the name of Lanice Patrick. And he has been with Lanice ever since then. He says that she is the rock, the person who stood by him and helped him turn things around. And he started to get back into baseball. He figures at this time, you know, he's only, 33 years old. My career is not done. I've got some, or he was 31 years old. He thinks that he's got something to prove. And after he cleans up his life, he was able to sign with the Oakland Athletics in 1989. That's right, right before the 1989 season. Signs on with the A's. He is in their AAA farm club in Tacoma. 6-6 record, or 3.18 earned run average, makes the 40-man roster in September in 1990, and was able to convince Tony La Russa, the manager of the A's, that he had at least one more shot left. So on April 11th, 1990, 15 years and a day from his major league debut, where he shut out the White Sox, coming in relief in the eighth inning of a game against the Minnesota Twins, here comes Mike Norris, and this is in the Oakland Coliseum. He was able to set down the side in order on 14 pitches, got Kirby Puckett to ground to third, Ken Herbeck to pop up to center field, gave up a single and a walk, however, was able to hang in there. Greg Gagne driving a line drive to left center field, but Dave Henderson able to make the out and to help Mike Norris earn the close there in that game in April of 1990. Now, his comeback would be short-lived. After all, he was 35 years old, not quite the young fireballer that he was in 1980. The A's also, if you recall, in 1990, had a few good arms in front of him, so he saw limited time. He did appear in 14 games, but had a 1-0 record, a 3.00 earned run average, and as is always a good sign for pitchers, more strikeouts than walks and no home runs allowed. So no starts, but he was able to provide some pretty good relief in 27 innings of relief appearances. Now, Mike Norris has had a little bit of tragedy since that point in time. He has been diagnosed with cervical myelopathy. That is a compressed spinal cord. Now, I have cervical stenosis, which is not as bad as myelopathy. It gives you some interesting days, but I've blown out disc in my neck and I have stenosis. And when you have your bad days, you have your bad days. But myelopathy can cause temporary paralysis, and he deals with that partial paralysis in his legs. He is still, however, a factor in the Oakland A's history. In fact, in 2007, he joined Vida Blue, Dave Stewart, and Mudcat Grant in a ceremony to honor 13 African-American pitchers who have won 20 games in a major league season. That was done at the Coliseum, part of the 13 Black Aces ceremony. So Mike Norris, who made a very quick rise up the minors, was part of a very bad team in the late 70s, and you weren't quite sure where he was going to go. But then he would turn things around in 1980, have almost everything come away from him in 1983, going down the crapper with drugs. Thankfully, he's able to pull himself out, find somebody to support him, and live the ultimate dream of being able to get back into the majors, not just one more time, but appearing in those 14 games in 1990. And kudos to Tony La Russa. And hey, we all pick on Tony La Russa, and for good reason these days. But kudos to Tony La Russa for, despite all the talented, incredibly talented arms that he had in his arsenal in 1990. Credit him for realizing that Mike Norris still had something to play for and something to give. And he was able to kind of turn around a lot of things in that 1990 season. Last but not least, we've selected a 1965 Topps card to show the comic tragedy of how the Dodgers tried to handle Glenn Burke. And through no fault of his own, Vic Davalio was one of the players involved in the decision-making that would ultimately help the Dodgers explain why they were trading Glenn Burke to the Oakland Athletics. So Vic Davalio, born presumably in 1939, records may vary, as many Latin American players would raise their birth age by a couple of years to appear older than they actually were. He was born in Venezuela, and he had a brother named Pompeo Davalio, who had the nickname of Yo-Yo, who played very briefly for the Washington Senators in 1953. 17 games of experience, never made it back to the big leagues. So there was some baseball in the Davalio blood. And the Cincinnati Redlegs would sign him as a free agent in 1958. Now, Vic Davalio would have a very long and bumpy road to the big leagues. He was in the Reds farm system for several years, also playing winter ball in Venezuela, where he would really star. But he just could not, as an outfielder, just could not latch on to the Cincinnati starting lineup. And of course, if you look at the Reds outfield in the early to mid 60s, pretty good reason why he couldn't get in there. There were some very talented players, not to say that Davalio wasn't, he just could not crack past them. Now, while the Reds couldn't find room for Davalio, the Cleveland Indians would, as they would pick him up off waivers and make him their starting center fielder and, in fact, leadoff hitter in the 1963 season. Now, Davalio would find success with the Indians as their starting center fielder for 4.5 seasons, won a gold glove in 1964 in that position, and in 1965, a breakthrough season for him, as he not only appeared in his only All-Star game, in fact, he was the starting center fielder for the American League in the 1965 All-Star game in Minneapolis, but he would also often be in the batting lead in the American League throughout the 1965 season. He would finish the season with a .301 batting average, this despite royally struggling against left-handed hitters, and he would finish third in the American League behind Tony Oliva and Carl Yastrzemski. Amazing, as all three of those players were the only three in the American League to break the 300 mark that year. Now, he would follow 1965 with an off 1966 season, rebounded in 1967, but after a slow start in 1968, he would get traded to the California Angels. Now, he would rebound after the trade, hitting .298 with the Angels, and had a final batting average for the season of .277. Now, while he was playing in Venezuela, he would suffer a nervous breakdown. Now, part of this was because of his fear of getting hit. Back in one of the previous seasons, he suffered a broken arm after getting drilled in the arm in a game, I believe it was against Detroit. Let's see, 1963. Yes. Hank Aguirre broke Vic's forearms with a pitch, so he was very scared of getting hit by pitches, so that was starting to weigh on him over many, many years. But then he just had so many other things going on in his life. He suffered a nervous breakdown and started off the 1969 season really, really terrible. And the Angels, who were a pretty bad team in 1969, decided to move Davalio. They trade him for Jim Hicks to the St. Louis Cardinals. So now here he is in the National League for the first time. And in his first at-bat, June 1st, 1969, what does Davalio do? He only hits a three-run homer. Oh, by the way, he appeared as a relief pitcher for the Cardinals a couple times in 1969, but did not do well in the Position Player Pitching Hall of Fame, as he didn't retire any batters. So he is technically one of 14 pitchers in Major League history to have posted an infinite earned run average. That's right. If you look at his stats, he's got that little squiggly sign for infinity. He does not have an earned run average. He is the only pitcher of those 14 to have pitched in more than one game and did not do very well in either. Now, as he was getting older, he became more valuable throughout the outfield and other various positions, was a platoon player, a utility player, pretty good pinch hitter as well. And in fact, in 1970, he had 24 pinch hits, which then broke the National League season record for pinch hits at that time. Now, after the 1970 season, he would get traded to the Pittsburgh Pirates along with Nelson Briles for Matty Alou and George Brunet. And it was good timing for Davalio, as he would prove to be a good outfielder as well as a good first baseman, and could be slotted into the lineup at any point in time as a pinch hitter. Had a .285 batting average and was a big part in the Pirates winning the World Series against Baltimore in 1971. He would continue to play for the Pirates in 1972 and into the early stages of the 1973 season. In July that year, the Pirates sold Davalio to the Oakland A's. And what do you know? The A's are able to plow through a pennant battle with the Kansas City Royals, winning the American League West, defeating Baltimore in the ALCS, and then defeating the Mets in the World Series. Now, the stories of why Davalio left the Oakland Athletics in 1974 are mixed. Did he have another nervous breakdown? Did he perhaps party too much and drink too much? There were some stories that he was a very rude and bad drunk. Or did he just butt heads with manager Alvin Dark? Some or all of those stories may be true. But the fact is, in May of 1974, the A's cut ties with Davalio, and he decides to go play ball in Mexico. In fact, he plays in the Mexican League for 2.5 years. That is when the LA Dodgers come along. They're looking to add some veteran outfielders to a team that in 1977 is looking to position itself as a contender, as Tommy Lasorda promised that the team would do. So they get some great scouting reports from the Mexican League, and even Al Campanis went down to Mexico to watch an exhibition game and loved what he saw. So Davalio gets signed by the Dodgers. Amazingly, at the age of 37, despite not playing in the major leagues in the previous 2.5 years. And he has a pretty solid 1977 campaign, appears in 24 games, mostly as a pinch hitter and as a utility outfielder, and hits .313 that season. He also has a very productive 1977 postseason as well. Has just one at-bat, but gets a base hit in the NLCS against Philadelphia. Appears in 3 pinch hit performances in the World Series in 77, and has a hit in that series as well. But this is where things go comically bad. Even though Davalio is doing some impressive things as he's about to turn 38 years old, there's some limitations to what a 38-year-old can do in the big leagues. Plus, you have the aching old Rick Monday as a utility outfielder, and the LA Dodger outfield was not exactly a group of spring chickens in 1978. In fact, Dusty Baker was the youngest of the 3 regular outfielders at the age of 29. You had 30-year-old Bill North in center field and 33-year-old Reggie Smith in right. Now, granted, Smith was still chugging along, hitting .295 that season, and Baker was still pretty productive, although not quite what he was doing in 1977. So the Dodgers had the chance to bring in Glenn Burke in a more prominent role. But instead, because they didn't want an openly gay player, again, not publicly known, but certainly well known in the locker room by that point in time, because they didn't want him on the club, they came up with all sorts of excuses and were basically running him out of town by the notion that players such as Davalio and Monday, as well as a utility player or two such as Lee Lacy, youngsters such as Rudy Law, Joe Simpson, they had a better chance. And that was just laughably bad because they knew how talented Glenn Burke was. They knew how popular he was. The fact is, they didn't want a gay player on their team. So they sent Glenn Burke to Oakland. Meanwhile, Davalio continued at that time to serve as a pretty useful pinch hitter and a utility outfielder in the 1978 season, appearing in 75 games and hitting .312, and again delivering a couple of good moments for the Dodgers in the 1978 series, which they again lost to the Yankees. He was still with the Dodgers 29 games. He appeared in 1979 at the age of 40, still appeared in 7 games with the Dodgers in 1980. Granted, his skills were diminishing. So even though Davalio decided to leave the major leagues, he was not going to leave baseball. In fact, he returned to the Mexican League for several years and continued to play in the Venezuelan leagues. In fact, he was still playing in 1987 when he was, again, depending on which birth certificate you read, around 48 years old. He was part of the league championship team, Team Leones, and was part of the 1987 Caribbean Series. And that was the point in time where he finally decided to hang it up as a ball player, but still very, very, very much involved in coaching and scouting, especially in Venezuela. And when the Venezuelan Hall of Fame for Baseball opened in 2003, he was part of the inaugural class of 2003. He also is part of the Venezuela Sporting Hall of Fame, which he was inducted into in 1991. So while Vic Davalio had a tremendous career for what he was, a useful outfielder who had some moments as a consistent starter early in his career, but again, dealing with nervous issues, anxiety, and perhaps alcohol problems later on, became more of a trustworthy utility player and pinch hitter. Here's a gentleman who played in 1,458 games, had a career batting average of .279 over 16 major league seasons that were interrupted by 2.5 years in Mexico. Even though he had an impressive track record, at the same time, you still look back, 38-year-old Vic Davalio against an up-and-coming and just incredibly talented Glenn Burke. it was pretty obvious why the Dodgers were moving Glenn Burke. It's not because Vic Davalio was a better athlete. It's because, well, by all accounts, Vic Davalio wasn't gay and Glenn Burke was. So there's our look at the bottom of the order. Three players involved directly or indirectly with the life of Glenn Burke. Vic Davalio, Mike Norris, and Davey Lopes. Well, I hope you enjoyed this podcast. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Andrew Marinus. Again, the book Singled Out, the biography of Glenn Burke, is out now. I highly recommend you check it out. It is very educating, entertaining, and enlightening. It is an easy read. It is not 800 pages long, but it is an easy read. I read it myself in about a week, and I think you're going to enjoy it. So make sure you check out Singled Out from Andrew Marinus. Make sure you learn a little more about the life of Glenn Burke and some other star players, or maybe not so star players from the late 70s and early 80s. And make sure you join us for our next podcast. As we go back to the 1950s, we will, by popular demand, revisit one of the lesser known sets of the 1950s. Look for the poll question to pop up in the next few days on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gumstains. Make your selection, and whatever you choose, we will discuss that set a little more in our next podcast, which will be on Friday, August the 27th. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks so much for listening. Please get vaccinated if you have not done so already, unless you have a medical reason to not do it. Please get vaccinated. COVID virus is going around, and it is a virus, and it's a epidemic for the unvaccinated. And unfortunately, there are people under the age of 12 who cannot get vaccinated yet. So don't just do yourself a favor, but do others a favor as well. Get vaccinated. And if you are vaccinated, please mask up just for a little bit longer and help one another out here. Let's stem the tide, bring the numbers back down so that we can continue trying to get back to normal as soon as possible. All right. Hopefully you take care of yourself and take care of others in the process. And that way we can all be back in 2 weeks for our next edition of Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you then.